Case number 10-523, Robert Gordon Appellants versus Eric H. Holder Jr. in his official capacity as Attorney General of the United States et al. Mr. Street for appellant, Mr. Abadi for appellees.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'd like to take 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Gordon is a small businessman who sells tobacco, as the Seneca Indians have done for centuries. The PACT Act threatens to put Mr. Gordon out of business and destroy the Seneca economy. The district court denied Mr. Gordon's challenge to the law on the sole basis of alleged delay, without analyzing any of the required factors for injunctive relief. This court should reverse the district court and order that the Act's unconstitutional mailing ban and taxation provisions be enjoined. I'd like to first address why the district court erred and then briefly turn to each of the three constitutional defects with the Act. The district court denied preliminary injunctive relief for the sole reason that Mr. Gordon filed his challenge to the Act shortly before the Act took effect. Now, it's telling that the government does not defend this basis for the denial of relief, nor does it cite a single case where delay, so-called delay, before a law takes effect is a sufficient basis for denial of injunctive relief. And that makes sense.
So what do we do here in that, if we agree with you? Do we just vacate the denial and send it back to the district court?
No. This court should analyze each of the factors for injunctive relief itself, just as it did in the CSX versus Williams case. These are complex constitutional.
How can we do, for example, on the minimum contacts, that's a critical issue. The Western District of New York and Second Circuit have taken interest in that. How can we do that without a factual record here?
Well, we do have a factual record.
We have the complaint.
And we have the affidavit of Mr. Gordon and Mrs. Gordon, which sets forth what their minimum contacts are. And the minimum contacts test, which I'll be happy to discuss further, is such that we can know on the basis of this record that Mr. Gordon does not have minimum contacts.
Anywhere in the United States?
Anywhere in the United States based on the record.
Making $2 million a year. So is it all in New York?
He does not. I'll turn directly to that. First of all,
so you don't think he has minimum contacts with any jurisdiction outside the state of New York?
Under Quill, there's a three-part test for what when remote sellers.
Yes or no? He has no minimum contacts outside the state of New York.
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position, and here's why. And we hope that this court gives guidance on the constitutional points to the district court on these important issues. And Quill is not a simple minimum contacts test,
right.
And I think that's very important.
It's a fact-intensive inquiry.
Well, it's a three-part test. The first is: did the remote seller purposefully avail himself of the privilege of doing business in the state? Second, was there a magnitude of contacts?
For that, the case law is developed. If you've got a website, you've got to know if it's interactive. And these are very fact-intensive inquiries, right?
Well, I think on the third point of the test, it's very clear that Mr. Gordon does not meet this, and that is that the remote seller has to derive some benefit from the state itself that's related to the tax that's being imposed. And in Quill, I think it's important to look at why this test.
So when somebody in Oklahoma buys some cigarettes from Mr. Gordon, and he ships it to them, if he's able to find some way to ship it to them, he's not benefiting from. And those trucks travel over the roads of the state of Oklahoma. He's not benefiting from Oklahoma in his transaction.
He's certainly not benefiting from it in a way that is related to the level of tax. In other words, it doesn't justify taxing Mr. Gordon at the same level as a brick-and-mortar retailer who uses all of the services of the state. And in Quill, the court found the test was met only because there were thousands of customers in the state, And they sent, they specifically reached out to that state with tons of catalogs, and the court said the state had to destroy those catalogs, and that was one reason that they could be treated as a brick and as much as taxed as much.
How many customers does he have nationwide?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
How many customers does he have in California?
That's not on the record. I mean, we know that.
Right. So how in the world can we make a decision? You're making a facial challenge to this. How in the world can we do that on this record?
Well, we're really asking that the act is enjoined as applied to Mr. Gordon, and that basis is that merely selling through an interactive website or selling through a website where the customers call and place an order is not minimum contacts under the Quill three-part test. And, Your Honor, we're perfectly happy as a backup if this court gives guidance on those points, interprets what Quill means in this context so that the district court knows it. But we've cited cases that show merely selling through the Internet into a jurisdiction is not minimum contacts, even for personal jurisdiction purposes, which does not apply the more stringent three-part test. Now, the government's view on this, and we'd certainly like the court to reject the government's view in its guidance that it gives, is that if the government does it, it's legal. If the Congress does it, then it can authorize that states tax remote sellers regardless of any minimum contacts. And that position was expressly rejected in Quill. Quill, of course, dealt with taxation of remote sellers, and the court said...
Do you think so? Because Quill was actually looking at whether states could do this. And so I'm wondering if Quill helps you here, because what they were looking at was what was sufficient under the Commerce Clause for states to be in the business of trying to enforce these taxes on remote sellers. But they sort of ended by saying, but Congress could solve this problem.
And, Your Honor, Quill does help us because you're referring to the second part of Quill. There are two parts of Quill. Right. The first part addressed due process clause. And the court said Congress can override the Commerce Clause's restrictions on the state's taxation of remote sellers. But it expressly said we can't authorize violations of the due process clause. Then later in the Commerce Clause section, it said, of course, Congress can override the Commerce Clause provisions. And I think there's a telling passage right after that where Congress says, we realize why Congress might, where the court says, we realize why Congress might not have acted, and it's because it couldn't override our due process decisions, which had the due process requirements were weakened a little bit in Quill. So we're asking this court at the very least to reject the government's interpretation.
What about the interpretation of the city of New York? That what's going on, that you can actually avoid this problem with the way that cigarettes are typically taxed through the stamp tax. Doesn't that solve your concerns about due process and minimum contacts? Mr. Gordon's not even paying the tax on this one, the wholesaler would be.
Well, it's telling that the government, which has to enforce this statute, has not adopted that interpretation. Now, the city of New York says Mr. Gordon doesn't really have to pay the tax. Well, we quoted the legislative history in a footnote in our reply brief. It directly says delivery sellers must pay all the applicable taxes. But it ultimately doesn't matter, Your Honor.
Statute say.
The statute says that any excise tax imposed...
Statute doesn't say what you just quoted, right? It's legislative history.
That's right.
The statute uses the passive voice, doesn't talk about who's selling it.
Right, but remember
that... You want me to disregard the language of the statute in favor of the legislative history?
No, I believe they're perfectly consistent. And my ultimate point is that it doesn't really matter because if Mr. Gordon has to make sure that the buyer pays the tax, which I think is the state of New York's position, that's still imposing a taxation obligation on a remote seller. And remember, that's actually what was happening in Quill. Remember,
it'd be indirect to him, right? As I understand the way this works, and that I'm not certain I do understand the way it worked, is that the wholesaler would purchase the stamp tax from Oklahoma, all these different states, sell it to Mr. Gordon, who would then sell it to the retailer. And so the tax, as I understand it, the taxing transaction would only affect him indirectly.
Well, that's part of the problem is we don't exactly know how this will work in all 50 states. And many states have different types of regimes. But either way, Mr. Gordon will be paying the tax at some point in the transactional process. And that's exactly what the court addressed in Quill. The seller in Quill didn't actually pay the tax himself. He was just required to collect the tax and remit it to the state. And the court still said due process restrains the ability of states to impose that type of obligation on a remote seller. So the real issue is, can a state regulate somebody who's outside of the state and doesn't have minimum contacts with the state, regardless of how that taxing obligation is structured? And certainly the PACT Act makes no attempt whatsoever to take into account the due process restrictions on the state's ability to tax remote sellers.
Let me ask you about something else, because I think at one point you said this was a challenge as applied. But his objection, of course, was made before the Act ever went into effect. So how is this an as-applied challenge?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's a little bit of a strange sort of an as-applied challenge. What I meant by that is that we're asking for it to be enjoined only as to Mr. Gordon. I mean, that's what we're really concerned about here. Now, what we're asking to be enjoined is the imminent enforcement of the PACT Act's taxation provisions. And the PACT Act, what the PACT Act does is requires the remote seller to pay those taxes. So if these provisions were lifted, right now they're enjoined by the Western District of New York's decisions, if these provisions were lifted and Mr. Gordon made a sale tomorrow, he would be under federal law required to pay the state's taxes. And so we're challenging that imminent imposition of that unconstitutional requirement upon him. Now, I'd certainly be happy to answer any more questions on that point, but I'd like to also briefly address the other constitutional issues. The mailing ban is completely unprecedented in United States history in that it bans the mailing of a product that is perfectly lawful in all 50 states, and it's not hazardous to mail carriers or others who would come in contact with it. And Romer tells us that it's the unprecedented nature of an act like the ban must trigger this court's careful scrutiny to make sure that the act is rationally related to legitimate government interests. But the act here is not rationally.
Just as a factual matter, what happened in New York? I mean, there's been reference to an agreement between the governor and Federal Express and its competitors. Not to do that. What, can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. Back in 2005, then Attorney General Elliot Spitzer took the lead along with other state attorney generals in basically jawboning FedEx, DHL, and UPS into declining to ship cigarettes in the interstate mail under threat of prosecution by the state.
Prosecution for what?
I believe it was trying to enforce the state's age verification laws and things like that. And it was really just a vague threat that big corporations like to avoid.
A tobacco company or something like
that. Right, exactly. And so the fact is that it's impossible for Mr. Gordon to use these third-party carriers now because of this national agreement. And then Congress has completely cut off, knowing that the U.S. mails was the only remaining option, has completely cut off that option with the mailing ban. And the ban's not related to preventing underage smoking, or to enhancing the tax collection by the state, because the Act already does that. The Act already requires delivery sellers.
Well, Congress can be redundant. They don't need to have only one arrow in their quiver, do they?
Congress may be redundant, but Congress may not act in a way that is so sweeping that a total ban is not rationally related to any remaining slight governmental interest that's left. And I think City of Cleburne is a good example on this point. Of course, that case involved a ban on a mentally retarded group home, and the court said that the city's interests in protecting property values and in preventing overcrowding were already addressed by the city's zoning ordinances. And so in that case, it was so redundant that it was irrational to impose this additional ban targeted at one group of people. And that's the exact same position that we have here. In addition, the PACT Act's taxation provisions are unconstitutional under the commandeering doctrine. States do not currently tax the sellers in these interstate transactions, and that's precisely because of Quill's Commerce Clause holding.
Don't you have isn't there a significant standing issue there? Whether you have standing to bring something on behalf of the states?
There is an open question in this circuit whether a private citizen can bring a Tenth Amendment claim or a commandeering claim. And we think that there's no doubt Mr. Gordon's been injured here, so he meets the traditional standing criteria. If this law is upheld, he'll have to pay taxes that he wouldn't otherwise have to pay. And it's important to note the government has already conceded that a private citizen can bring some kinds of 10th Amendment claims. They say that, but they can only bring them, they say, if they are arguing that Congress exceeded its Article I powers. Well, New York versus United States shows that that's an untenable distinction. New York says the 10th Amendment and Article I are flip sides of one another. And New York, of course, is a commandeering case. The court said, we're holding that this is commandeering, and that means that we're also holding that Congress exceeded its Article I powers. So there's no basis for making that kind of distinction. And we think the court should go ahead and hold their standing to bring the commandeering claim and consider the merits. And on the merits, the Act purports to shift the burden under state taxation law from the buyer in the transaction, who's currently taxed because he's within the state, to the remote seller. Now that sort of intrusion on core state sovereignty, state taxation issues, cannot be sustained. And the government's only real argument is, well, the PACT Act doesn't actually do that. They say the PACT Act just applies whatever pre-existing state laws apply, but that means the Act would do nothing, because states don't currently tax the sellers on these interstate transactions. That's the whole point of the PACT Act, is to shift these taxation burdens over to the sellers. And so the government's argument's not only contrary to the text, which says any excise tax imposed by a state, it's also contrary to the structure of the Act, because of the way one provision of the Act says you already have to comply with the state laws that do apply, and then another provision says, and by the way, you also have to pay any excise tax imposed by the state. And of course, it's inconsistent with the purpose of the Act, which is, as the government says in other parts of its brief, to shift the taxation burden onto the sellers. And if there are no further questions at this time, I hope I'll get a few minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Counsel for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Abadi for the United States. I'd like to begin, if I could, with the mailing ban, since that is the only issue on which plaintiff is currently asking for relief he does not already have by virtue of the injunction from the Western District of New York. We think plaintiff's argument on this score is flawed on two parts. First, it is factually not true that it would be unprecedented for Congress to enact a mailing ban of this sort. And secondly, it's legally irrelevant. There is no principle of law that plaintiffs have cited that limits Congress's plenary control over the mail to banning only those things which are dangerous. And in fact, Congress has done this on several occasions. It has banned locksmithing devices and motor vehicle master keys from the mail. They pose no danger to the people who receive them and are legal in plenty of circumstances. Plants are non-mailable in certain circumstances under 18 U.S.C. 1716b. Forged agricultural certificates are illegal, as well as mailing of illegally taken fish, wildlife, and plants. So the mailing ban at issue here is not in any way irrational or unprecedented. Congress found that
two different things, aren't they?
They are two different things, Your Honor.
Yes.
And it is not irrational because Congress found that the use of the mails was a principal way that delivery sellers were evading enforcement of state laws concerning not only taxation but sales to minors, and a whole host of other state requirements that apply to the delivery, receipt, and sale of cigarettes. There are laws implementing the master settlement agreement entered into between the tobacco companies and the various state attorneys general. Those can be circumvented by anonymous mailings. Congress found ample problems related to the mailing of cigarettes, and there was nothing irrational about banning their transmission through the mail. And as Judge Griffith pointed out, Congress can take a belt and suspenders approach to the many problems that are caused by delivery sales. So we think that it's clear that this survives the minimal rational basis scrutiny that even plaintiff concedes governs that claim. I would also like to address the due process and commandeering arguments that plaintiffs have raised. Plaintiff addresses the due process argument, as he did this morning, as if
can
it's...
Can I get it back
sure.
up? And
of course.
Something more troubling to me is the order that we're reviewing. Where are the findings of fact and conclusions of law that are required for in Rule 52 in the district court's decision here?
They're not there, Your Honor.
They're not there.
No. We do not dispute that the court did not make a full evaluation of the legal claims that were presented here.
So what are we supposed to do in chaplaincy of full gospel churches? We set it back and said, try again. Would you agree that's what we should do here?
This court could choose to remand. I think that's absolutely an option available to this court.
Obviously it is. Should we do it?
Well, in this one sense, we agree with the plaintiffs. As a matter of efficiency, we think that this court could choose to affirm on the alternative bases presented in the record, which is that there are no, in our view, there's no likelihood of success in the merits here, and that this court...
You think there's a sufficient record here for us
to
answer the minimum contact?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because we think that's a purely legal question, and we think it's governed, and this is what I was about to say, we think it's governed by the fact that Congress has enacted this statute to enact a level playing field for the conduct of interstate commerce. There are ample cases going back nearly a century from the Supreme Court saying that when Congress regulates commerce in that way to require compliance with state law, it is not subjecting businesses to the authority of the states. That was rejected in the James Clark distilling case, in the Kentucky whip and collar case that was cited in our 28J letter, and as well in the McGrath case, a three-judge district court from the District of Columbia affirmed by the Supreme Court. All three of those cases squarely reject the proposition that Congress submits businesses to states' authority when it regulates in this way.
What is your response to counsel's argument that may be well and good for the Commerce Clause problem, but it doesn't solve the due process issue?
No, we think that actually squarely solves the due process issue, because the crux of his due process argument is that you are subjecting me to the authority of the states with whom I don't have minimum contacts. But those old cases from the Supreme Court have long rejected the notion that they're being subjected to the authority of the states. These businesses have minimum contacts with the United States, and that's all that the Due Process Clause requires for this minimum contacts inquiry. Congress has jurisdiction over interstate businesses who conduct interstate commerce. And in our view, especially when combined with those old cases, that's the end of the matter. I think it's telling that plaintiff himself did not raise...
I don't think that what's really working here is that these out-of-state sellers are being subjected to state taxation.
Well, they have to pay state taxation, but it's not by virtue of the state's authority. And that's, in James Clark, the Supreme Court said it's a mere misconception to suggest that the businesses in that case, they were selling liquor over state lines, and they argued that the Red Kenyon Act subjected them to the authority of the states, and that was improper. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's a mere misconception. It is the will of Congress, and not the will of any individual state, that requires the compliance, and were Congress to change its mind tomorrow, compliance is no longer required. And that's all that Congress has done.
Congress can't allow the states to tax out-of-state sellers when there are no minimum contacts. They can't go that far, can they?
Yes, Your Honor. Congress can say you must abide by all state laws that govern the conduct of this business, including taxation laws. There's no distinction between, in the case law or anywhere, between taxation laws and other forms of regulation. Justice Scalia said that exact thing in Quill. And if you were to somehow hold that this law were to violate due process, then any other similar statutes go out the window, regulating explosives.
Could Congress tell me that I have to pay Nebraska taxes on a meal purchased in Virginia?
That may be irrational, but I don't see how that's a minimum contacts violation. The entire minimum contacts inquiry is whether or not the sovereign who is regulating you has contacts with you, has authority over you, has jurisdiction over you. And it's clear that these businesses are subject to Congress's will. There may be other problems with the law you posited, but it's not a lack of connection to the sovereign that's regulating you.
But Quill does say that these two inquiries, the Commerce Clause and due process, are separate and have to be distinguished, right? So what I'm not understanding is what your argument is, that you seem to be saying because Congress does it, you know, it's all subsumed, it all becomes one, and there's not two separate inquiries.
No, Your Honor, and I want to be very clear. Our argument's actually quite narrow. Our view is that where Congress has regulated, it solves both the Commerce Clause problem for obvious reasons, but also the due process minimum contacts problem. I'm not saying that it eliminates any other kind of due process problem that plaintiffs could come up with, but the only due process claim here is minimum contacts. We don't have connection to the sovereign who's supposedly taxing us. But Congress does have minimum contacts and has jurisdiction to regulate in commerce. And our view is that specific due process problem goes out the window where Congress legislates.
So how does Congress's minimum contacts mean that the remote seller here has minimum contacts? That's what I'm not following.
Well, The sellers...
The taxing authority isn't Congress. The taxing authority is the state of Nebraska.
The tax that ultimately is paid is the state, yes, but James Clark and Kentucky Whip and McGrath all established that that doesn't mean you're being subjected to the authority of the states. Each one of those cases squarely rejects the notion that you're somehow being governed by the state where Congress says you must abide by the laws of the state. It is still Congress's will. So Congress cannot tell you, Congress can't say, you must follow all state laws. If the state law is somehow procedurally or substantively invalid for some other reason, then yes, the plaintiff would have a due process objection to compliance with the state law. But that objection can't be, I don't have sufficient connection to the sovereign who is forcing me to do this, because they are clearly subject to Congress's authority. If not, Congress would have no more authority to regulate interstate commerce here than the states would have under their own power. If you require minimum contacts, before Congress can say you must comply with that state law, then it's unclear what power Congress would have in this regard. So we think this is a pure question of law and one that has long been resolved. And in fact, plaintiff didn't even raise this claim in his complaint. He did not perceive this supposedly fundamental problem until the district court in the Western District of New York entered the injunction. And we think it's fundamentally flawed, and we've appealed that decision. But we submit that it's a clear question of law, and Judge Griffith, while we agree with you that if this were a challenge under the state's authority, all of those facts you posited would be necessary to prove that the plaintiff lacks minimum contacts. Here, we don't think any of that's necessary, just because it's a question of law. Similarly, on the common dealing claim, we think that's an easy question of law answered by the text of the statute itself. The PACT Act says that delivery sellers must ensure that any tax that is imposed by the state has been paid prior to delivery. It doesn't change state tax law in any way. It just says if you're a delivery seller, you must comply as if you were doing a transaction within the state where you ship the cigarette. Find out what the law is in that state and comply. Now, as a practical matter, Judge Griffith, to answer your question, the way this normally works is simply that the wholesaler, the state licensed stamping agent, has to obtain a tax stamp from the state and affix it to the pack of cigarettes that's going to be sold in that state. The delivery seller is not running around each state paying a tax for each cigarette. In fact, the delivery seller can only buy their cigarettes from a wholesaler, and under the PACT Act, you must make sure that you are buying cigarettes that have been pre-stamped for the state into which you're selling it. At the moment, plaintiff, like many other delivery sellers in New York, is obtaining from a wholesaler unstamped cigarettes and then reselling them across state lines. The PACT Act says no more. You can't do that. You must ensure that your cigarettes have been pre-stamped with the state tax stamps from the places they're going. So we think that as a common...
So again, help me with the practicality
yes.
here. So Mr. Gordon gets an order from Oklahoma to ship 30 cartons of cigarettes. He then goes to the wholesaler and says, sell me your Oklahoma stamp?
Yes. I mean, the easiest way to do this is what the Seneca, another Seneca Nation retailer, Scott Mabee, mentioned in our brief, has done. He has actually set himself up as a multi-state stamping agent and wholesaler. Plaintiffs could do that, or they could rely, well, on Mr. Mabee, who will be able to do third-party transactions, or another wholesaler. You'll be able to take an order from Oklahoma. You call up your distributor and say, please send 30 cases of cigarettes to Oklahoma. The shipment will go directly from the wholesaler to the consumer. The bill will go from the wholesaler to the retailer, and then the customer and the retailer complete the transaction. So, in fact, the plaintiffs never need to even touch these cigarettes. They just need to have a licensed distributor, wholesaler, for each state into which they're going to ship their products. And it's a pretty straightforward mechanism. And like I said, one of these other retailers has already set himself up in this manner and will be well positioned to do these third-party transactions once the PACT Act goes into effect. If this court has no further questions,
no.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel for Appellant.
Thank you. I'd like to briefly address each of the constitutional issues, although first I think it's important to note the government doesn't dispute that the district court got it wrong on the issue of delay, nor does it dispute either today or in its briefs irreparable harm, which is another of the first two important factors. And there's no real serious dispute that the balance of harm here favors injunctive relief. The only harm to the government is returning to the status quo ante of a few months ago, while the Gordons are being subjected to an unprecedented act that is at this very moment driving them out of business. Now, turning to the mailing ban, all of the examples that the government gave, they focused on the dangerousness issue, but left out the fact that most of those products they mentioned are illegal. They mentioned illegally taken fish. Well, obviously, Congress can prevent the shipment of illegal items. But as Judge Rogers said, whether or not it's unprecedented, the law still has to be rationally related to government interests. And as we've explained, that's not the case here. Now, the government just cannot come to grips with Quill here. A Quill addresses the very argument that the government's making. A Quill is talking about minimum contacts with the state. And Quill says that Congress cannot authorize states to tax remote sellers unless there's minimum contacts with the state. The government's three cases that they cite, as they call them, the old cases, are very different, and none of them involved taxation of remote sellers. What they involved was Congress banning the interstate shipment of a good that was illegal in the state. So that's why the court said in those cases, Congress is not subjecting the sellers to state authority. The sellers don't have the authority to regulate interstate commerce. But and that's very different from here, because here Congress is precisely subjecting the sellers to the state taxation. It's not a federal tax. And second, those cases are fundamentally distinguishable because in all three of those cases, and particularly McGrath, the Jenkins Act case, the court expressly said that these are laws that the state had constitutional authority to enact on its own power. It wasn't Congress elevating the states to be able to do something that it otherwise was prohibited to do under the Due Process Clause. And that's what we have in this case. Now, with respect to the commandeering claims, first of all, however this statute works, and it's not at all clear that what we would do would be go to a foreign state and say, please send me your stamps, although you can imagine how burdensome that would be when you have no idea how many sales you're going to make. But even if that's the case, for us to have to reach out to a remote state and say, please give us a certain number of stamps, we have to buy those stamps, so yes, it's taxation, and yes, it's a state taxing a remote seller. So that doesn't solve the due process issue, nor does it solve the commandeering issue, because states don't currently do that practice under state law, because states recognize under Quill they are prohibited from taxing remote sales. And that's why it's telling that the government didn't say that all the states are already doing this, and the PACT Act just makes them do what remote sellers already have to do. No, the PACT Act wouldn't do anything if it made sellers do what they already do, because sellers don't pay in-state excise taxes in the states of delivery. And so we're asking this court to reverse the district court at the very least, give guidance on these constitutional claims that the government has conceded are pure issues of law, and enjoin the act.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. Good morning, 9:30. Thank you.